Take a network break. It's late August in the hottest summer on record, and the icing is melting off our virtual donuts, so please excuse our sticky fingers as we rifle through this week's tech news. I'm Drew Conry-Murray, and with me is Greg Farrow and one of our favorite guests, Mike Fratto from Current Analysis. Before we tackle the news, I want to thank today's sponsors. Network Breaks being brought to you in part by CloudGenix, and they're hosting an SD-WAN mixer with the Packet Pushers at VMworld 2016. You can meet the Packet Pushers live, enjoy free food and drinks, and find out what an SD-WAN application-defined branch looks like. So see CloudGenix.com for more details and to register for the event. And thanks to Mellanox Technologies, which is reshaping Ethernet switching with the SN2100 switch. Cut costs and space while doubling your performance with Ethernet switching from Mellanox. And for a limited time only, you can get $4,000 rebate on your first purchase. Just visit mellanox.com/2100rebate or email them at offers@mellanox.com to start redesigning your data center today. All right, getting into things first, this is show 100. 100
show
network
100.
Break.
Hey. Woo-hoo. We should have some noise going on here. Like,
We need a zoo crew now.
So that's a long time, Dre. Well done.
Thank you. Well done to you too. Yeah, we've abused people for 100 shows, and they've kept coming back for more.
Yeah. Well, and thanks to everybody who's listening for show. It's actually the statistics on the show are steadily grinding their way upwards. We're getting, what is it, more than 10,000, more like 11,000 people listen to download every show, which is usually a rough guideline. We don't actually know how many people download the show because it gets syndicated away. It's an open feed. And a lot of the times it gets downloaded and then sent off into other people's networks. But that's the number that we can talk about publicly because we can validate that.
That's right.
Which is cool. So there's a, you know, so you and 11,000 of your best friends are listening in to show 100. or something like that.
We thank you for doing that. And also thank you for the emails, the messages on social media, pointing us towards stories or giving us critiques or things we could do. We definitely love feedback. If you've got more, you can send it to us at packetpushers@gmail.com. We always want to improve the show, so let us know if there are things we can do better.
Yeah, definitely. And don't you can tweet at us as well or hit us up. We don't really check Facebook or LinkedIn that much, so that's not always the best way to get us. But certainly on Twitter, we keep a close eye on what's happening there. So if you haven't signed up for Twitter, maybe it's the time to chance to do so. But if you want to give us feedback or tell us when something's wrong or when Drew gets his grammar wrong.
I never do, ever.
But, you know, some of the what we would especially love is there things – that we should change? Like, is there something you'd like to see us cover? Should we have more guests? Should we have more topics? Maybe we should have less topics. Or maybe we're doing something wrong. Maybe you don't like the way the tone of my voice, or I'm saying too much, or you think my opinions are rubbish. Love to hear from you. Send it in and let us know, and then we'll be able to take that on board. And if enough people tell us that we're not getting it right, guess what we'll do? We'll fix it.
That's right. Unless it's about the tone of your voice or your rubbish opinions, I don't know if we can fix those.
No, well, you know, I'll try harder to make more rubbishy opinions. How's that?
That's right. We'll make them worse.
Who knows? Maybe.
And Mike, thank you for being with us on the 100th episode. That's cool.
Hey, thank you. I've been listening to you guys for 100 episodes. That's a lot of information to absorb.
It's a lot of opinions.
There's a lot of news in the industry. It's easy to forget that there's just a lot happening in like networking specifically, but even wider across the industry. There's so much happening, it's even difficult to pick out what should go into the show most weeks.
Yeah, that's right. As the weeks happen, sometimes I worry, like, are we going to have something to talk about? And inevitably, we have something good. So thanks, industry. Keep it up.
Yeah, that's right. Although I wish we had less conference stuff, like they hold all the stuff for conferences and you can have a few boring weeks there.
That's true. Yeah. Well, we do our best. All right, so this is supposed to be a new show, so let's get into it. Let's start with Cisco Systems. They announced that they were going to lay off 5,500 employees in the coming months. That's 7% of their workforce. And at the same time, they released quarterly financials. And in fact, they beat Wall Street expectations. They're reporting revenue of $12.64 billion for the quarter, which was up 2% over last year, with a net income of $2.8 billion.
Yeah, so this is a yearly event. Cisco, around about this time every year, goes through and cuts somewhere in the region of 10% of jobs as a headcount. Now, Cisco subscribes or has done for the past decade or so to the philosophy that that they should sack 10% of staff every year. Like literally 10% of staff should move out the door, and it shouldn't be staff choosing to move out the door. They should be actively migrated to other locations where they can achieve their maximum potential.
That's how HR puts it.
That's how HR puts it, yeah. You're not achieving your full potential with us. Off you go. I noticed on the Twitter that we've seen several sales teams be dispersed. So Headcounts seem to be largely focused around the enterprise business unit. Now, the thing to remember here is that the enterprise business unit is shrinking rapidly. The other part of Cisco's results was that enterprise revenue only grew by 2%, and that overall it's been shrinking by about 5% over the last 12 months, and that the prediction is that it'll continue to shrink going forward. So you could expect the bulk of these job cuts to happen in the enterprise BU, especially in those products that aren't doing so well. And also where Cisco has made acquisitions and they haven't been successful, they will externalize those people. So, you know, companies that they've acquired, they pick up several thousand headcount during the year just from that process alone. They will then look at those businesses to evaluate whether they should be there, and those that aren't doing what they need, or maybe there's people not working to their full potential as they wait for their earnout, maybe they're encouraged to head for the door. So not unusual. It is an odd thing for Cisco, however, to lay off staff and for everybody to actually notice. That's the strange part, I think.
I think one of the reasons this job cut bounced into the headlines so hard is because it was, you know, a publication, I think CRN originally reported that they were laying off 20% of their workforce, yep, which was rather eye-popping. 7% still substantial, but way down from 20%.
Yeah, that was kind of a crazy number coming out of CRN, but you know, I think every year, if layoffs are higher than 5%, it tends to pop into the news, and then all the doomsday people come out saying Cisco's faltering, since Cisco's going to fail because this is evidence of it, that they're cutting off cutting out so many employees, when really it's really kind of an adjustment. I didn't notice anywhere anybody saying where those cuts were actually coming from.
Mm.
So it could just, you know, it could just be sort of across the board, or like Greg said, maybe concentrated more in the enterprise space. But it's a typical annual adjustment for them.
Yeah.
Well, Cisco in the press release did say that the money they're saving from the layoffs, they're going to reinvest it into security, IoT, collaboration, next gen data center, and cloud. They're seeing those as growth areas. So we can do some reading of the tea leaves there.
Yeah, that was a big theme from Cisco Live, both from Robbins and the rest of the executives. Those seven pillars or focus areas that they were going to, you know, sort of drive towards. So that just makes sense.
Yeah. Well, the rest of it, I mean, there's some quite interesting stuff in there. Routing is the largest revenue source for Cisco, 15% of total revenues, and that revenue shrank 6% in the quarter and 4% year over year. So sales of routers, particularly to service providers, is shrinking strongly as service providers hold off to decide what to do. So we've heard that service providers are backing off. And also because the American dollar is struggling, as it gets stronger, it gets harder for Cisco to sell them at higher prices because it makes space for other people. So one other research paper that I read talks about ACI. Although ACI grew by about 34%, it pointed out that the rest of the whole switching business, if you fold ACI into the enterprise BU, only grew by 2%. So they're drawing the assumption that ACI is growing at the expense of the existing business unit. So therefore, ACI is not doing so well in terms of the bigger picture, which is something I've sort of been saying for a while.
Yeah, and another note, Cisco is forecasting for Q1 2017 revenue of -1% or just 1% growth.
So, yeah, and that's, I think you'll see more infrastructure get cheaper. That'll start to undermine, you know, Cisco's moving away from selling high price switches to the enterprise and selling commodity switches based around the Nexus. So the capital value is going to drop. But at the same time, they're making a lot more money out of software sales. Now, the question here is, if they're selling software licenses, that's high profit margin, high revenue. If they're selling it as SaaS, that business, so software as a service where Cisco has to develop and run infrastructure, that's not such high margin. And the research community is sort of suggesting that we're not sure where Cisco's going to go in the long run, whether it's high profit, high margin, and how soon it'll be before Cisco's revenue picks up as its recurring licensing kicks in.
Yeah, it's. I don't think it's exclusive for them to continue to focus on the high margin business as well as a lower margin business. And with their SaaS play is really sort of two pronged. One is going after, through the VAR and through the channel, right? direct, as well as providing that software and hardware components for their partners to build up their own cloud. So there's going to be a mix of both. But if the SaaS service can take off, that can be a high margin business.
Mm. So one other factor that I was reading a report from George Notter at Jefferies, and he's highlighting that receivables DSO, that's days outstanding on invoices, is way up at 42 days. That usually indicates that Cisco's numbers weren't doing well in the quarter, and then they went out and beat the sales force with big heavy sticks, and the number came in at the end of, like, everything was ramped up at the end of quarter, because that's why the invoices are right out. So the concern here is that if Cisco sucked a whole lot of deals forward from the current quarter, that it could presage some sort of weakness going forward. I did do some sort of impromptu surveys among some user communities, and the suggestion was that, yes, the Cisco salespeople were way more desperate than usual in the last quarter, so perhaps there's something in that. But that's not hardly, you know, a representative sample. A handful of people doesn't make a conclusion.
All right, well, we'll definitely always be keeping an eye on Cisco. And we talked about Cisco and software. So Nutanix announced last week that its software has been validated by Nutanix to run on Cisco UCS C-Series. And it seems like Nutanix is doing this independently of Cisco, because Cisco has been pretty quiet about this development. No press releases, no corporate blogs.
Welcome to Cisco's Byzantine politics.
I don't know if this is... What's going on here with Nutanix doing this sort of on their own, saying, hey, we've certified it ourselves? According to Nutanix, they'll support all the software elements, but if there's a problem on the hardware side with the UCS, you've got to go through regular channels. Mm. It seems like they're doing this without Cisco's official blessing.
I wouldn't think so. I suspect Cisco's been involved, but they're still not. Cisco's still pushing along many different hyperconvergence platforms. It's got its own, of course. It bought a storage system and then built its own vertical stack. It's doing stuff with Pure Storage. It's doing stuff with Nimble. It's doing stuff with a whole bunch of hyperconverged players. And I suspect it's standing back and trying to take a Switzerland type of view. You know, we partner with all the hyperconvergence companies, but no one's special. We love you all. I love all my children. Do you know what I mean?
And it's far more beneficial for Nutanix to say they're certified. You know, it provides that comfort level to enterprise buyers that we've tested it, we know it works. You know, we're just not going to support the hardware because we're not Cisco's, you know, technical support arm. But you know, it provides that comfort level that it will work. I mean, it makes sense that it would.
Mm-hmm.
By certifying it, they just saying, we've tested it, we validated it. You know, off you go.
Yeah, I don't think this is a particularly big deal, because Nutanix has its own hardware. It's got itself on Dell, and now it's gone on to Cisco UCS. If you happen to like running software on UCS servers, then this is happy days for you, perhaps.
Yeah, Nutanix is also on Lenovo.
Yes, and you know, like some customers want to keep their existing servers. They feel that servers actually matter for some reason. I'm still out on this. I don't see why a particular brand of server matters against another brand of server. I agree that, you know, some might perform better than others, and these orchestration, the software hardware defined features that these things have got, like virtual NICs and so forth. But you can get those with any NIC on any server these days. You can buy any third party NIC and drop it into a server, and you can have a fancy NIC in there that does the virtualization on SRIOV. It's not restricted to these companies. And I'm also wanting to respect the fact that, you know, you buy a solution and it's got a single throat to choke and all that sort of stuff. But it does seem a high price to pay for these servers with custom silicon in them. But if you're, you know, if Cisco UCS servers are your thing, now you can start to look at your Nutanix, and it opens up a market for them. And in theory, getting access to Cisco's reseller channel might be a strong move. It certainly worked for a lot of other companies.
Yeah, I see why this is good for Nutanix, and also good for customers who like Nutanix but also like Cisco. But I'm just curious what it means internally for Cisco, because they're also trying to push HyperFlex, which is their own hyperconverged system. Greg, you've talked about all the time about how Cisco has sort of an internally, you know, competitive model where they pit business units against each other. Maybe they're not saying much about it because they know there's going to be some pushback from inside.
Yeah, well, I think part of what you're seeing with Chuck Robbins is he's breaking down that competitive structure. So we saw NCEMI get sucked into the enterprise BU recently, and you know, that sort of stuff. And I think that's happening across the board. And you don't change a big company overnight. I think Cisco says, we're the last server vendor who isn't aligned with other people. So Dell's with EMC, HPE's got all the portfolio, but we're just making servers. You should come and partner with us, because we're not competing against you in the hyperconvergence space. So they're trying to just say, you know, keep it quiet. do lots of things with all the different people and just push product out the door. I don't think this is a big deal. I think this is just normal. Or potentially the person who's running the product relationship hasn't done a good job of doing press.
Yeah, there may be competition in the channel because they do have HyperFlex, which is going to compete with Nutanix, and, and Cisco's going to you know, they're going to provide spiffs and other benefits to their channel partners to lead with HyperFlex over a Nutanix on UCS solution for those channel partners that have both. I think that's where you're going to see more of the competition.
Yeah, it sounds like somebody needed to beat something up. I'm not sure. Nutanix does have a reputation for being somewhat weird to do business with. Like, they're not easy people to get around sometimes, and the CEO has offsided a lot of people. So maybe that has something to do with it.
Now we're going to move on to Google. We actually talked in the last show about how they've been rolling out fiber internet to some cities, but running into snags in some places with their wired competitors employing delaying tactics. So a couple of websites are reporting that Google has filed a plan with the FCC for nationwide wireless broadband in 24 cities, probably using point-to-point wireless technology from Webpass, which is a company that Google acquired in June of this year.
I think there's a couple of things happening in here. Probably the biggest one is that 5G looks like it's going to get legs. And 5G is the successor technologies to 4G. I was at the Intel IDF conference. We'll talk more about that later. But absolutely huge presence from Intel in the 5G space and how it's going to change the world. Talking around different people, it's actually going to happen sooner than you think. We're in 2016. The guess is that 5G will actually be widely rolled out by 2020. And the thing about 5G is it has several modes. Some of them are low latency, high speed. Some of them are high speed, variable latency. And you can actually start to do mobile broadband fundamentally over a 5G wireless under certain conditions. There's a whole bunch of caveats here, but in principle, 5G could potentially support high-density mobile broadband, especially in the cities. You still need fiber in the backhaul, although 5G will actually contain a mesh networking capability between 5G base stations for certain types of things. I think that what we're seeing is that Google has achieved what it wanted to. It's kicked the service providers to start doing things to roll out faster bandwidth, and they've had some reaction or some improvement in that space. But I think, you know, I've heard numbers that when you trench fiber into the ground, it's somewhere between $250 and $500 a meter in the ground. And it takes like 20 years to get that money back when you're renting it out at $100 a customer or $50 a customer per month. So if 5G can come along and give you a short-term, you know, gain, you can start putting these base stations down and do mobile broadband over wireless technology, then you having fiber in the ground is actually not a feature. It becomes a bug because it just becomes a cost burden at that point.
Yeah, and it's an excellent way for Google to continue to put pressure on the broadband providers to, you know, drop rates, increase performance, you know, just basically treat their customers like decent human beings rather than, you know, sources of money and you know, because they've been fighting to get pole access in a lot of these cities and you know, frankly, where Google has had an impact is very localized. It's in the cities where they've rolled out Google Fiber. They've had really good impact on competition, but that has not spread anywhere else because there's no need to, right? Because if they're not somewhere, you know. It'll be good to see the 5G that this Google Wireless spread, because it will definitely put pressure on wired and wireless providers to step up, and maybe we'll actually get some competition in the U.S.
Well, and I think in the U.S. particularly, where Google Fiber has been, the incumbent carriers have used, you know, every trick in the book to prevent them from rolling out fiber optic. We saw Facebook announce its mobile phone platform recently. They released some open source software to encourage companies to build 5G networks or step in that direction, right? Don't misinterpret what I'm saying. But and if that comes true, then Google can get its goals by starting to promote the use of 5G and maybe even just using fiber in the backhaul as a way of putting high-speed 5G, and then they don't have to do get arguing with town hall to run fiber, and that takes away a lot of cost and annoyance.
Well, you still have to argue with the FCC if you're dealing with radio, but maybe that's less burdensome than, you know, individual municipalities all over the country.
I think for Google, who would rather have one big fight than have 100 running fights.
Sure.
They would see, you know, an argument with the FCC is much less of an embuggerance than arguing with 100 city councils. and you know, like Pittsburgh Council or whatever it is, those kind, and you have to deal with councils all around the town. Like, not only do you have to deal with the one in the city center, each one's individually negotiated, and that would be not something that Google does well. But you know, going to town on the FCC, that might be a whole lot more in their style.
Yes, one giant suitcase full of cash instead of many smaller suitcases full of cash. It's a lot easier to manage. All right, let's take a minute to thank our sponsor, CloudGenix. Greg, you and Ethan are going to hang out with CloudGenix at an SD-WAN mixer at VMworld coming up next week.
Yes, indeed. CloudGenix, of course, is the maker of an SD-WAN technology. We've had them on the show a couple of times, and they really do have a real focus. The thing about their SD-WAN technology is that focus on application recognition and selection, so you can be very granular about its control. And so when they approached us and said, let's get together and have a mixer and get you guys to come along so that people can meet us, we said yes. So we're having an SD-WAN mixer at VMworld. So if you're in Las Vegas next week on Monday, August the 29th, from 6 to 8 p.m., you can come and hang with us and discuss what SD-WAN application-defined branches look like, and we can swap notes on your favorite cocktail or alcoholic beverage. CloudGenix will also have the I Want CloudGenix Challenge Station set up, so you can actually head over to it and do a live configuration, and we can all cheer you on. I'm looking forward to going, ooh, ooh, ooh. Well, somebody just to make fools of people. There'll be some free drinks and some food and some T-shirts and giveaways as well. So in the meantime, go over to cloudgenix.com and make sure you get registered, for this is not an event you want to miss. This is going to be great fun. We have done a couple of these now, and they're huge fun to meet up with other people. So if you're at VMworld next Monday night, please come and see us at 6 p.m.
6 to 8 p.m., August 29th. At the MGM, go to cloudgenix.com. You do need to register the event, so please go sign up if you want to come, and we'd love to see you. All right, and now back to the news. Open vSwitch, that's an open source virtual switch, a popular alternative to VMware and Cisco. They've joined the Linux Foundation as an official project.
Yes, so this is a transfer of ownership. So Open vSwitch has been largely running as a self-standing open source project, and it has now become part of the mothership, where all fine open source projects go into the Linux Foundation. I generally think this is a good idea. I think that the Linux Foundation does a great job of supporting open source projects. So if you're a developer, we want you writing code. We don't want you running mailing lists and, you know, handling GitHub stores and accounting and all that sort of stuff. Linux Foundation takes care of all of that. It gives you access to training material. And if you want to run a conference, you can, you know, the Linux Foundation provides a whole back end for open source projects in a, you know, neutral and well-structured way. And there's also the certainty. The Linux Foundation works a certain way. So if you're a vendor, you know where you are. If you're, you know, a customer, you know exactly how the processes are going to work and what the rules and regulations are around this body. So, yeah, good move to get Open vSwitch and to move it, you know, away from VMware to some extent and to start opening up to even more people in a normally structured way.
So I get the operational benefit for the open source projects, but what I'm curious about, what I don't know is there any benefit for any of the projects going into the Linux Foundation to improve collaboration with other projects, improve integration, or is it really just sort of the operational benefit, the back end, all that stuff? You guys know?
Yeah, my understanding is it's just the back end. So the developers run the project. They continue to decide the directory. The community, you know, he who contributes the code gets to decide where it goes. But the Linux Foundation provides, you know, accounting, rules, legal, you know, GitHub accounts, you know, handles the money that's associated, you know, the small amount of money that's associated with it. So, no, if the developers decide they want to do cooperative ventures with other things, that's up to the developers to, and the people involved in the project to do that.
Yeah. Mm. Interesting.
But there's so many open source networking projects under the Linux Foundation now. They've got Open Daylight, they've got Onos, they've got OPNFV, now they've got Open vSwitch. That it seems like, Mike, I take your point, even if there's no sort of official collaborative effort, there's got to be back-channel conversations and such going on.
I suspect that there probably isn't. I think the developers who are running these projects probably aren't looking up from their keyboards to look around. And there's no product managers, right? There's no competitive analysis. There's no... These people are running open source projects. Why would they, you know, why would Open vSwitch care what iAdvisor or FDE.io is doing in the virtual switching space?
Well, maybe what you're describing, though, Greg, is that if they're already collaborating, this doesn't make any change to that collaborative process, right? If they're already collaborating with another open source project, whether it's in the Linux Foundation or elsewhere, they're still going to continue doing that. Right?
Yeah, but it's developer driven. It's not driven by a product manager or some executive. right, who might see some value in synergy.
Right, but developers do talk to other people sometimes.
I guess. Don't be too sure of that.
Yeah, I was just my question was really more, you know, some of the startup incubators encourage you know, collaboration with other startups in those incubators. So the question was really more, is the Linux Foundation sort of acting like that kind of incubator environment? And it sounds like not really.
No, you know, I don't believe so. Although I suspect that, you know, if developers are spending less time on mechanics, you know, and they might be able to take more of time to start looking around at what else is happening in the market. So that might actually happen as an outcome, but not as a deliverable.
All right, sticking with open source, Greg, you pulled out a story. It was about a talk that Martin Casado gave at an OpenStack conference about how open source is changing the sales procurement method.
Yeah, so he gave a YouTube video as well. You can actually watch it. And basically what he's saying, and he also did a podcast on the A16Z podcast where he talks about this, and he says it's absolutely true that open source can bring startups to market. And so startups can build a product and use open source to get noticed and for people to adopt it. Like, the hardest part of a startup getting traction in the market is that getting your first 5, 15, 20 customers is the hardest part into live actual deployments so that you can start growing your business. On the other side, giving away your software for free doesn't actually build sales. And you've got to be really, really careful about you know, giving it away so that you can't actually make a product out of it. So open source is, at its root, a product marketing exercise for many startups. If I give it away, I'm marketing my product to an audience which is otherwise I could not reach or I could not afford to reach. But then once you've got that open source, you've got to work out how to turn yourself back into a marketing engine and build a sales force, build a product management team so that you've got a product to sell to people in the traditional things.
He was also talking about how open source is, you know, instead of going having to go through the regular channels, an IT manager, a CIO, whatever, a VP, who you as a startup obviously don't have contact with, that they're reaching right out to developers and sort of bypassing that whole traditional buying cycle.
Yeah, doing a handshake between your legs sort of thing. Yeah, open source, like lots and lots of stuff. Like the success of Linux in the enterprise has largely been driven by, I didn't want to write a purchase order for Microsoft Windows, or I didn't want to have to buy another high expensive and write a purchase order. And so I can just take a leftover computer and put Linux on it and get started. And that's largely how Linux got through the door in many, many enterprises. And over time, it actually worked out that it worked pretty bloody well. And why are we paying money for an operating system, which, you know, it's not really a big deal anymore. You just, why are you paying for Windows, you know, or AIX or HPUX or any of those other ones? And but the challenge, of course, is that if you do come in through that pathway, how do you suddenly appear on the CIO's radar and say, and put your hand out and say, I want money for this product? How do you sell it? How do you market it?
Yes. Yeah, that was an important point, that you still have to sell. Because you're open source, you still have to sell.
Yeah, and I mean, so Linux took off in the enterprise. It took a long time. There's a long ramp, right? You know, probably 7 or 8 years from when, you know, from the early 90s when people could download and install Linux and you know, put Apache on it or other software. It took a long time for that to take off, and it really wasn't until Red Hat sort of put the backing that companies stopped paying Microsoft, they started paying Red Hat, right? And so there was not quite,
because when you have Red Hat, you don't pay for every instance, only some critical instances,
right?
So you run Fedora. The classic model in the enterprise is about 60% of your instances are Fedora and about 40% of them are Red Hat. Your exact percentage in your organization may vary.
Yeah. So, but it took a while for that to take off. And what's you know, the mechanism was IT could, it is subversive. IT could grab the open source, could grab Linux, install it, test it, say, see it works. Let's run some stuff on it. And then it grew from there. And with current open source projects, so looking like Open Contrail is a good example, and there were a few others that names are escaping me. You know, in talking to those vendors, they do see a pull through from when they open sourced parts of their product. They do see a pull through from that open source deployment to actually a paying customer, but they have a significant challenge in tracking that, largely because if they're allowing open source, they're not making you register, so they can't always.
Yeah,
you know, draw that line.
We live in an analytics-driven society where everything's supposed to be tracked, and yeah. open source is antithetical to that.
Right, and people who download it, they don't want to register, right? And so, yeah, it's an interesting conflict, but also in some research that we did last year, some IT research, you know, using open source or an open source model or a freemium was actually I was surprised it wasn't it wasn't a leading pathway to sales. Mm. You know, the leading pathway was mainly going through salespeople, the traditional sort of channel, give it to me, let's do a proof of concept and move on. And there was some pathway from open source, but not all that great, which I thought was surprising.
Yeah, the thing is that if you've got an open source version, it assures people, takes away some of the risk. So if you're an enterprise and you're buying into a product and you don't know if it's what you want, you either come through the open source channel and come up, so the back door. But if there's a commercial product, you might want to say to yourself, well, even if this company walks away from this product, at least I can use the open source version until I can migrate away in a timely and reasonable fashion. There is a reverse direction here.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because I can get the source code. Like if you do business with Google or Facebook and you're selling them a networking product, you want them to, they demand you give them the source code. So for this reason, not because that product might be in a critical location, and if they can't get support, they'll pull their own developers in to get that done. Now, that's a unique use case, but I think you're seeing the same thing happening in the enterprise, where at least if they've got access to the source code, in theory, they can do something about it. Right. And I know in the enterprise, when some companies buy very expensive, very large projects, they will demand that the code goes into escrow so that if the company, the startup or smaller company that they're doing business with, starts to go awry, at least they've got access to that. Or if it goes broke, then the source code is released out of escrow for them to be able to track it.
Right. Mm. Yeah.
The other thing that was interesting in this speech, I just read a summary of it on Light Reading. We'll have that link. Is that it sounds like Andreessen Horowitz is looking for companies, looking for startups that are building on open source, but not just taking the Red Hat model, trying to sell you a product. What they're looking for are services built around open source, because a service is apparently a little bit easier to monetize than trying to sell someone, you know, an operating system or some other package software.
Yeah, the general belief in Silicon Valley is that Red Hat is a one-off model that, you know, this ability of selling open source for many, Red Hat happened to be in the right place at the right time, and that model is unreproducible. You know, giving it away doesn't get you where you want to be. And yeah, A16Z loves to see open source projects, but it loves to see them product so you can make money, because A16Z is expecting a 10 times return on their investment. So if they put $10 million into your startup, they're expecting to get out at $100 million. And so if you're not doing that, then, you know, you've got a problem.
But if you've got an idea for a service built around an open source product, maybe go talk to Martine.
Have a look at Amazon. It's all built on open source technology by and large, with some develop, you know, some custom development work. Yep. And yeah, except they don't give much back. So, but hey.
All right, well, I'll leave that there. Some more news from the industry. Hewlett-Packard Enterprise, they're acquiring SGI.
Yeah, SGI is one of the leading vendors in the high-performance compute space. They've been very big in absolute leading-edge high-performance compute for decades, I think. And I've always sort of stumbled around. And I think this is a sign that the high-performance computing market has been a little bit off to the right or the left. You know, it's not quite in the mainstream. And so there's been space for companies to exist as specialist high-performance computing suppliers. The trend towards commoditization and standard x86 means that a lot of high-performance computing doesn't require custom silicon. As in the old days, SGI used to make its own chips and its own special high-speed buses and special graphics cards, and today you can get x86s. So companies like SGI, and there are many others like SGI, who became companies who are very good at responding to tenders for tens of millions of dollars worth of computers in a single deal once every 5 years. Which is, most high-performance compute infrastructures aren't bought a piece at a time. They're bought in one big lot. And then you're talking like 1,000, 5,000 computers and X petabytes of storage, and it goes into the racks and the compute stays there for 3 to 5 years before it's thrown away and replaced. It's a specialist sort of a sale process. So my assumption would be, A, HPE wants to get into high-performance compute because that is a growing segment at 6 to 8% over the next 3 years. B, it's buying market share, so by acquiring SGI, they instantly get access to SGI's customers and can start switching them into HPE x86s and storage, and maybe there's some IP in there as well, I'm not sure. And then they also get a team, so they get a built team, sales team, to go out there and sell large volumes of hardware in a few infrequent deals.
A question that seems like going after a very specific market, it maybe even, is it fair to call it a niche market? Seems a little bit contrary to the whole spinning out of HPE to be sort of your big enterprise vendor and so the chasing individual markets. I don't know, is that a dilution of strategy?
No, high-performance compute used to be a specialist art form, and now it's very much just every day. And even a lot of enterprises are building a small HPC. So a lot of them are running Hadoop or Apache Spark or one of these, you know, big data applications inside of their infrastructure. And sometimes you just need a couple of racks to be able to get away from it. And this is a way of, for them to get those skills in-house, add them to their existing portfolio, boost their capabilities, and focus, and maybe just focus on those very specific technologies that achieve the ultimate performance and bring that inside and be able to monetize that on their existing reseller channel.
Okay. I guess I can buy that. Well, let's take a quick break to thank our other sponsor for today, Mellanox. Mellanox Technologies, they've been a pioneer in high-performance interconnects for over 17 years. They recently introduced a revolutionary new Ethernet switch that's changing the shape of the modern data center. The SN2100 is the ideal top-of-rack switch. It's got high density, a 19-inch side-by-side footprint to allow maximum flexibility, and enabling full-rack connectivity to any server at any speed from 10 gig to 100 gigabits per second. It's got unique benefits like full redundancy in 1U, line rate performance for all ports at all packet sizes, full SDN support, and zero packet loss. The SN2100 delivers more than twice the benefits in half the footprint, and with flexible port speed configurations all active out of the box, the SN2100 allows a variety of blocking ratios that suit any application requirement. In fact, Mellanox is so sure the SN2100 is the perfect fit for your Ethernet network, they're offering a $4,000 rebate on your first switch purchase. Just visit mellanox.com/2100rebate, that's 2100rebate, or email them at offers@mellanox.com to start redesigning your data center today, and please tell them you heard about it on Packet Pushers. Coming back to the news, we've got some market results from Arista.
Yeah, this is in particular, I was flipping through a presentation that Arista gave to analysts during its Q2 2016 results a couple of weeks ago, and I stumbled across this chart, which basically shows that Cisco's market share in switching, data center switching, has fallen from 73% to 60%. You'll have to go to the website to see the chart. And in the meantime, Arista's grown from 3.4% to 12%. What Arista's basically saying is they're stealing market share from Cisco hand over fist. And I think I've said to you several times as we talked about the Cisco versus Arista case, I've never quite understood why Cisco was chasing after Arista so aggressively. I've said that several times, haven't I?
Yes, you have.
Yeah. And now all of a sudden I understand. If Arista's taken 12% of switching, you know, like taken this much market share out of Cisco's pocket in 3 years, and it's still going up and shows no sign of leveling off, Cisco needed to do something. They obviously didn't want to compete on price or some other thing. So that it explains why, they launched the case. Keep in mind that launching these legal cases is very distracting for executives. It costs a lot of money, and it also has a negative impact. Customers generally sort of frown on this behavior. So for Cisco to do all of these things, it really meant there had to be a motivator, and I think this is what it is. And it also explains why they're searching for taking the case to the International Trade Commission and saying that this is a copyright ban and searching for immediate injunctive relief to prevent Arista from importing parts from overseas. So they didn't want to wait 3 years, 5 years, 10 years for this to go through the courts. So going to the extra trouble of taking the case to the ITC while Arista is stealing literally substantial amounts of market share every year. Now we understand the logic, I think, a bit better.
Yeah, this chart is pretty stunning. Lays out a strong case for Cisco being a little panicked at seeing market share evaporate.
Yep. So I'm not sure why Arista would be baiting Cisco by putting this into its results. Maybe it really does feel confident, but it does seem. So anyway, I just thought that you would like to know that. And have a look at the graph, and you'll probably understand why the case is going to go on and why Cisco is pursuing it so aggressively.
Yeah, what I find interesting about this is not only that, you know, Cisco's drop in market share and Arista's, you know, incredible rise, but also the thing that we keep hearing, especially, and this is a big concern from the financial analysts, is they've been predicting or they've been concerned about white box switching eating into Arista's growth. And that doesn't appear to be the case because they're still going up into the right. And they're still selling into the cloud scale data centers or larger data centers, the very place where white box switching was supposed to eat everybody's lunch. And so I don't know if Arista's growth is due directly to Cisco's decline in port shipments and if there's any impact from white box switching, but it would be interesting to sort of know that.
Yeah, if you go into their results, they sort of hide the fact. But yes, the answer is white box is eating into their revenue in that the cloud providers are buying Arista, but increasingly they're buying Arista for the backbone, but not the top of rack.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I know that some of the financial analysts are saying, yes, Arista's getting plenty of sales in its cloud class, so sales, so in its cloud chassis stuff that goes into the Super 7, as I heard it was last week, the Facebooks, the Amazon, the Netflixes, the Googles, and there's a couple of others in China, in Asia, that they want to talk about as the Super 7. And I think even LinkedIn is moving away from proprietary gear to in the top of rack to its own custom build locally. And I'm not sure that Arista's going to have what they want. But I think white box is undermining Cisco, but Arista's the bulk of Arista's revenue comes from the Super 7s. So the cloud revenue in particular, and that's the growing market share. And Cisco hasn't had a great success there. So.
Yeah. Well, Arista's been very focused for the last, I don't know, 7-8 years on on making EOS extremely integratable, if that's even a word. being Linux-based, and, you know, you could IM commands to your Arista box, you know, via Jabber. And they could just continue to add accessibility, which the cloud scale providers really like. They can go in and they can really make it do what it wants.
Yeah, they can puppetize it or chef it or Ansible it or whatever, and they do things. The other story I've heard a lot of is that EOS as a software and the hardware itself is just reliable.
They really
feel that and Arista's made a big deal about their software being, you know, modern architecture, modern development, much better tested and, you know, so forth. And the general feedback I've been receiving from people right across the industry is that EOS is far more predictable and that's highly desirable from a customer's perspective. And they sort of point the fingers at Cisco's older products, which is not necessarily a fair comparison, it must be said. But Cisco earned that reputation. So, you know, Arista's certainly been capitalizing on that.
Yeah. I mean, it even goes with Arista's Arista's development going, bypassing the Broadcom SDK and writing directly to that chipset. They're treating the Broadcom chipset, off-the-shelf chipset, as if it were proprietary, essentially, by writing their own drivers, writing their own software, you know, really eking out whatever performance they have. So it kind of puts an interesting twist on this whole sort of this meta argument of white box off the shelf, ASICs versus custom ASICs, which Cisco is still very much sort of driving, right? They're both basically doing the same amount of work. It's just, you know, Arista's buying a bunch of Broadcom stuff and Cisco's buying some Broadcom and some of their own custom.
Well, Arista's also keeping its options open. It can also pick up anybody else's silicon and does for some line cut. So it doesn't, you know, it's using Broadcom sometimes, but it's also using Marvell or Intel's Fulcrum or you know, Vitesse or Microsemi or one of the others who make their switching silicon in different sorts of line cuts. So here's a bit of scuttlebutt for you. The suggestion is right now is that Arista's got two choices as to where it goes from here. And one is that it either goes into optical, so starts to add optical capabilities to its existing chassis so that the big companies can get rid of having separate DWDM gear or at least connect, you know, reduce the cost of connecting to the DWM for DCI, which is important to the cloud companies. Or the other way they can go is to take EOS and turn it into a full-blooded internet router. So take Cisco on in the routing business at the edge. So, you know, MX, the ISP class routers.
Yeah.
Which would make sense. You know, both of those work.
Yeah. Getting into optical probably makes more sense as a stepping stone first and then moving into internet scale routing.
I would agree, yeah. They did a deal with Infinera recently, a partnership, but apparently Infinera is not entirely it's expressing a certain amount of that doesn't seem to have gone too far. Who knows?
And just a slightly contrary note on this market share piece, that this chart that I'm looking at, despite the growth for Arista and the drop for Cisco, Cisco still has five times the market share of Arista, according to this chart. So let's keep that in mind.
Yeah, that's what I said. I was being fairly caveated, but that line up and to the right, Cisco's dropping steeply and Arista's climbing steeply. Cisco doesn't want that to get out of control and have to fix it after the fact.
Absolutely. So, absolutely.
Yeah.
But we're still talking five times.
Well,
Arista is not the only competitor Cisco has to watch out for.
Sure.
Outside the U.S., they have to watch out for Huawei, who is an incredibly large company, and they're going after market share globally.
Yes.
So, and they're seeing really good growth. So it's, you know, Cisco has a lot of companies to worry about, and yeah, they're keeping their eye on all of them.
Yep. And they also earn it all in U.S. dollars, which is a problem right now.
Yeah.
So anyway, neither here nor there.
All right, and last but not least, Greg, you were at the Intel Developer Forum last week. You got some interesting tidbits you want to share?
Yeah, so Intel, of course, is the – I often call them like they're the arms dealer. They make the guns, but they hand them out to other people to go and conduct the war. So x86s are sold equally to all the vendors, and they all turn them into servers and then go and try and sell them to customers. And they've always been in a very strong position. Now, on the good side, Intel's been a very good partner to all of those people, played a fairly fair game. So when Intel suddenly starts manufacturing ARM processors, your eyes pop open and go, what? And so Intel has actually bought a license to the ARM CPUs, because Intel ARM is a software only, so they only design the CPUs and then sell a license to use them. And the Intel Custom Foundry Division, which is the division that manufactures CPUs to order, has now going to start manufacturing CPUs for other people to buy. This is quite an eye-opener, because Intel stayed well away from the ARM and has refused to sort of, you know, get into that market and left it open for its competitors to drive that sales. And the trick here is that once you've built a silicon fab, you have to keep the production lines working to get a return on that investment. So this is probably a realization that the ARM is in the smartphones. It's very hard to remove, and they have to keep those foundries running. So this is a step in that direction. Start producing ARMs and keep a hold of the customers who have been buying CPU, you know, silicon from Intel, I think.
And not just smartphones, but also IoT and other embedded devices going forward. If that's going to grow like it's projected to grow, Intel has to be there.
Yeah, Intel's Atom has really made strides forward. They didn't talk much about it this time. I suspect we're in the down cycle around the Atom, but they're continuing to innovate on low-powered stuff. But for now, ARM has the momentum, and I think Intel has to sort of bow to that to some extent. One other thing that they announced, which was really, really exciting, was that Intel was highlighting its silicon photonics using a hybrid indium phosphide silicon laser. I hope you remember that, because there'll be a test on that at the end. Basically, what they did was they actually announced a 100 gigabit SFP compatible module, and it'll be using silicon photonics to drive the laser. So instead of using a full-on indium laser, which requires a massive amount of power and very expensive to manufacture, this is now the 100 gig CWDM/CLR4 standard, now commoditized down to a very simple low cost. And they were really, really proud of this, because manufacturing silicon photonics has been coming for over a decade. We've been told that this innovation is just around the corner. And for Intel to stand up on stage and say, yep, we're ready to go here, that's actually really something, I think.
Intel has, over the last couple of years, has been making some significant pushes into the networking space. And so this seems like, on the hardware side, another push by Intel to become more of a player in networking.
I think it's more Intel wants to manufacture more of the stuff. Mm-hmm. So take, for example, they also announced a thing called the Intel Curie, the C-U-R-I-E. This is a little tiny module. It's about the size of a little tiny board. It's sort of like a Raspberry Pi type thing. But the processing capability that's on here is that it's actually all ready to go to be able to do like IoT type stuff. It does image recognition. It does scanning. It does a whole range of stuff that you need for IoT, monitors, temperature, distance, things like that. And you can very quickly. And what Intel's done is not just manufacture the chip and shove it out the door, they've also produced a whole bunch of open source software to go with it. So more than just, you know, making a chip and shoving it out the door and then trying to sell it to people to put into their devices, they're actually making a fully combined system and then it working directly with the developers to make it work. A second product that was announced is the Intel Jewel. Now, this is really, really interesting, because this thing is literally the size. It's really, really tiny, and it's a full-on Dell key, but it keeps into a thing called RealSense. Now, RealSense is the ability to build robots, augmented reality, virtual reality type stuff. So you can actually put one of these into something, and it has a whole bunch of libraries and processing engines around what they called around augmented reality or VR. That is, you can project things on top. So these, again, are like CPUs or motherboards for this IoT generation. They got a picture of the Joule. It's about the size of a US quarter dollar, which is, what, 25-cent coin?
Mm-hmm.
What do you call them, a dime or something?
A quarter.
A quarter. Right.
It being one-fourth of a dollar, we call it a quarter.
Yeah, well, if it's called a quarter dollar, I should have realized it was a quarter. I don't normally keep the coins. So they were selling that. They did various demonstrations around this. It's really interesting again. And the final one they demonstrated was a thing called Project Alloy, which is a virtual reality headset. And they actually walked around on stage showing this how it worked. They're going to – but the real kicker about this is plenty of virtual reality headsets around the place is this one had one thing, which is it has no – normally you have to allocate an entire room space, and then you have to put sensors at the corners so that the helmet can find out where it is. This one uses a bunch of separate sensors inside the headset itself to know where it is. So as you turn around in the room, and it doesn't need cables either. So it runs on battery, sits on your head. So great, that's all fantastic. And not only, again, it comes with software, everything's ready to go. They were demonstrating games that were written in this, and they're going to, and the final kicker was they're going to open source the whole thing in mid-2017 so anybody can build their own VR headset.
That's really interesting, because I was just talking with my family about virtual reality and what it would be like to actually try to play a virtual reality game in our basement, because I would kill myself tripping over a couch or smashing into a support pole or knocking over the TV. So that's obviously someone's been thinking about this.
Yeah, well, the software showed that as you get close to something, it suddenly appears in the image. Mm. So if you're actually facing the wall or somebody standing in front of you, the software will suddenly bring their image into what you're seeing so that you know that you've breached some sort of space problems, which was cute. So to sum up those particular observations, I thought there was a couple of things here. One is Intel isn't just building CPUs and saying, here, go and use my chips, glue them to a motherboard, you know, and then blah, blah, blah. They're actually making the entire device. So the chip comes glued to the motherboard. They were producing cameras. They are producing sensors of a whole range. And then they're providing the operating systems for those. And they're providing software to do basic functions. So anybody could make there was one person who put the Intel Curie directly into a 3D printed robot. And it was able to follow him around the stage. And he said it took him less than 2 days to make that happen. Wow. Now, right? So you're talking about almost really all you need to do is take these things, drop them inside of a plastic case, and you're sort of in business. Now, obviously, that's going to be more complicated than that, but Intel's making sure that their devices are ready to consume so developers can just pick them up. They don't have to think about hardware production or deep hardware production. And Intel is deeply involved in producing software for these, right? So they're going to go out there and attack developers and get those in front of people. And I thought that was a really interesting change. We've seen Intel in the open source community contributing code like to Linux. It has vast numbers of developers paid for by Intel who contribute to the Linux kernel and the operating system more generally. And that lesson from that is about how it drives x86 sales and drives sales for Intel seems to have been carried over into the IoT. So these things sort of excite me in the sense that IoT, I had always sort of thought, would take a long time to come about. It's going to take ages. It's going to be slow, and people have to put things together. I think if Intel's going to produce these pre-packaged sort of solutions, it could happen very fast, much faster than I previously thought.
Yeah, because putting together an IoT package with sensors and all the rest of that crap is if you're not deep into hardware, it's really hard, because it's everything from cabling, physical interfaces, power, getting access to the various hardware features via the SDKs and all of that stuff. Intel knows developers. I mean, that's what they know. Very much like Microsoft knows developers, Intel knows developers. And this is the first I'm hearing about these. So I'm actually really excited about the Curie and the Joule. I think those things are pretty cool. Intel making anything easier for developers just to grab the hardware and go, that's
going to
unlock.
Yeah,
it's going to unlock all kinds of stuff.
Yeah.
Very, very cool.
Yeah. And, you know, good business for Intel. And like I said, they've done a good job of staying on side with everybody. So there's hope that, you know, be widely adopted. I've got more to say about the Intel IDF, Drew, but I think especially around 5G and NFE. But I'll tell you what, we might carry that over to next week. We're running long today already.
I think that's a good idea. All right, so that does wrap it up for this episode of Network Break, our 100th episode. Greg, if folks want to get more from you, where can they find it?
You can find me on my blog at Ethereal Mind and on the Twitter as at Ethereal Mind.
Mike, how about you?
You can find me on Twitter at mfratto. Yeah.
All right. I'm Drew Conry Murray. I blog at packetpushers.net, and you can find me on Twitter at drew_cm. Thank you to our sponsors, CloudGenix and Mellanox, and see our website for links about them. And thank you for joining us for this episode of Network Break. Hopefully we can do 100 more. If you enjoy the show, please like us on Facebook, leave a recommendation on iTunes, or share a link with your friends. And check out our newsletters, Human Infrastructure Magazine and Link Propagation. You can find out how to sign up for those at packetpushers.net. Thanks for listening.